Hinshaw Insurance Law Radio is on the air. From Los Angeles, I'm Royal Oaks of ABC News and the law firm of Hinshaw & Culbertson, LLP, inviting you to join us for Hinshaw Law Radio. This program features prominent lawyers and insurance industry professionals discussing insurance and reinsurance cases, issues, and developments. Before we get started, a reminder that the information on Insurance Law Radio is provided for general information purposes only. Nothing stated in the program constitutes legal advice or creates any attorney-client relationship. You should consult directly with an attorney of your choosing if you wish to obtain any advice with respect to any claim or matter. Any views expressed are those of the guests and are not necessarily the views of Hinshaw & Culbertson, LLP, or any of its clients. And now we go to Chicago and your host for Insurance Law Radio, the co-chair of Hinshaw & Culbertson's National Insurance Services Practice Group, Scott Seaman.
Thank you, Royal Oaks, and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Insurance Law Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. It's hard to believe that we're already working on the second half of 2019. We hope all of our listeners had an enjoyable 4th of July weekend. And while you guys were all barbecuing and watching fireworks, we were all hard at work preparing this episode of Insurance Law Radio. Okay, well, maybe not. But we did look at our calendars and we realized that it was time to examine some of the cases of interest that came down during the first part of the year. And we are joined by our favorite guest, Jeff Sistrunk from Law 360. He's the senior insurance reporter. And we're going to take a look at some of the cases that Jeff identified in his June 18th article in Law 360 entitled The Biggest Insurance Decisions of 2019 Mid-Year Report. And I'll add a couple of cases and mention some legislative developments along the way. And Jeff, thank you so much for joining us. It's great to have you back on Insurance Law Radio.
Well, thanks for having me. It's always great to be here.
Now, I don't want to put you on the spot or anything, but is there any announcements that you'd like to make before we got started?
Well, as we discussed a little bit before the show, I did get engaged to my girlfriend Natalie on the day before the 4th of July. So, yeah, so we're fast-tracking for a wedding this fall. I've been running around and making preparations, and we're very excited.
Oh, that's terrific. Congratulations to you. Natalie's a very lovely and lucky young lady, but I have to say, one idea, I'm looking at my producer now, but what if we were to do a live radio broadcast of your wedding?
I'll run it by her. I think that would be
we'll
a lot of fun.
We'll see how that one flies.
But fun for the listeners.
Yeah, in the meantime, why don't we'll stick to the script a little bit. The first case that you identified comes from the Texas Supreme Court, the Anadarko Petroleum case, and it involves the Deepwater Horizon disaster. Why don't you fill our listeners in on some of the facts and issues in that case?
Sure. So this case was yet another case that stemmed from the Deepwater Horizon oil platform explosion and spill, and as I'm sure the listeners know, that incident has produced a lot of presidential cases over the years, including the NRA Deepwater Horizon decision on the effect of certain contractual provisions. And this was another high-stakes case that came out of the incident, and it involved the Anadarko Petroleum's efforts to recover $100 million in defense costs that it's expended defending against dozens and dozens of claims that came out of the Deepwater Horizon disaster. And so two lower courts, so the trial court and then the Court of Appeals, had held that the terms of the specialty energy industry policy that Anadarko had acquired from certain underwriters at Lloyd's had a joint venture provision that interacted with several other policy provisions, and the lower courts found that it capped the underwriter's overall liability for everything, including liability and defense costs. But the Texas Supreme Court took another look said that the way that these specialty policy provisions interact, there was no cap on Anadarko's defense costs, and as a result, sent the case back to lower court for further consideration. And so the could be that the trial court takes another look, decides that all of the defense costs requested are covered. None of them are. You know, it's just going to depend on how the facts are further developed. But from the energy industry policyholder's perspective, this decision provided quite a bit of relief in terms of companies looking for defense cost reimbursement of defense cost over and above the limits in their policies. So yeah, it was a big case for companies doing business in the Lone Star State, and it remains to be seen what happens with that matter on remand.
Well, absolutely. And one could agree or disagree with the Texas Supreme Court's construction of that joint venture endorsement, but the distinctions it was drawing between liability, damages, and defense expenses are not distinctions that are without basis. And I think, as you point out, very important case for the parties given the dollars involved, but I'm not so sure it's a very important case in terms of precedent, because we're dealing with a pretty unique loss, the Deep Horizon, Deepwater Horizon loss, and the court is not construing, you know, standard policy language. This was, unlike most policies that were primary policies, there was no duty to defend. It was looking at a joint venture endorsement, and as you mentioned, no final decision as to what cost or what particular expenses might constitute defense expenses, but an important case nonetheless, and certainly an impressive case from the standpoint of the dollars involved. And I just got handed a note, Jeff, that actually apparently the reason or how you got to meet Natalie was she heard you on Insurance Law Radio and fell in love with your discussion of the cases. So that augurs well for the future.
That's what it was. It was a shared love of really abstract insurance legal concepts that brought us together.
And so between dates, the Georgia Supreme Court came out with a decision that also made your hit list of the most important decisions in the first half of 2019. The Georgia Supreme Court's decision in First Acceptance versus Hughes. What was that case all about?
Sure. So this was another case in a long line of recent cases dealing with the prerequisites for filing a bad faith action. And the Georgia Supreme Court had issued a number of decisions over the past couple decades dealing with this issue. And they took the opportunity with this ruling to clarify that in order for an insured or an third party accepting an assignment of a policyholder's rights under its policy to lay the foundation for a bad faith action, there had to first be a time-limited demand that specified the amount of damages being sought and the deadline for the insurance company to receive or refute the offer before the policyholder, the assignee, can turn around and sue later for bad faith. And this is an important case from the standpoint of both sides of the insurance bar, because in recent years, at least from the insurance industry standpoint, a number of plaintiffs' attorneys had been setting up what are called gotcha demands, where they would present an unreasonable demand on the insurance company following an accident, or present a demand that wasn't subject to a deadline, and then rescind that demand and say that the insurance company had refused to pay in bad faith. And so the Georgia Supreme Court took a look at the facts of this case, said that there was not a viable settlement demand offered in the case at hand, which involved a multi-car accident that resulted in injuries to a number of parties. And as a result, they found that under the court's, the Georgia Supreme Court's past precedent, that the insured here had not formed a valid foundation for a bad faith claim, and as a result, entered judgment for the insured or the insurer. Apologies. But yeah, so going forward, I think the Georgia Supreme Court's decision will provide guidance to parties on both sides of the insurance bar. And from the insurance industry standpoint, they're hoping that it'll cut down on some of these, what they perceived as unwarranted or unsupported bad faith claims.
Well, I don't know if I'm going to succeed, but I'm going to attempt to try to tie in as many cases to Natalie as possible. And of course, the name of this was First Acceptance. And if I'm correct, Natalie accepted your first proposal, right?
She did.
Okay. So a couple of things interesting to me about the case. First of all, as you say, the court recognized there's no duty to settle unless and until there's a valid offer to settle within policy limits. And the court recognized the sound policy reasons supporting the requirement of such an offer, including avoiding unreliable, speculative, self-serving after the fact evidence offered about whether the injured party would have settled or that sort of thing. And the other interesting thing was that the court determined that interpreting the offer was an issue of law for the court. And the court noted that any ambiguity in the correspondence of counsel for the injured party must be interpreted against the injured party in determining that there was no deadline for accepting the demand. And this is one of the rare instances in which contra pro referendum works to the benefit of an insurance company. So that takes us to actually the Montana Supreme Court decisions. And this is a twofer. And you have done this before where you sort of pair a couple cases under one. And Natalie liked that because she thought the same thing was going to happen with respect to engagement rings, that she would wind up with two for the price of one. Did that happen?
Well, yeah, we actually got the engagement ring and matching wedding band to go with it. So,
bingo, this is playing out beautifully. So the Montana Supreme Court, which is not exactly the bastion of insurance coverage rulings, came out with a couple of noteworthy decisions. Let's talk about Abbeyland versus Glacier first.
Sure. And so, as you mentioned, the Montana Supreme Court, I would imagine for most listeners, flies under the radar. And that's one of the things that makes insurance law so intriguing and so unique is that you have the 50 state system of insurance regulation. And as a result, you have a lot of varying precedents coming out of the Supreme Courts of the respective states. And so these two cases, of which Abbeyland versus Glacier Construction Partners is the first, dealt with the enforceability of consent judgments, which, as I'm sure listeners know, involve a situation in which a policyholder agrees to settle a case with a third-party plaintiff for a predetermined amount with the promise that the third party will not try to collect the judgment out of the insured's assets and will instead seek to fill it through the insurance policy proceeds. So I won't bore listeners with the details of either of these cases, as there were many, but in Abbeyland versus Glacier, there was a consent judgment that was reached between the insured and a third-party plaintiff in a massive dispute over the construction of a mansion on an island in Montana. And the thing that was interesting and unusual here, that the parties in question were both controlled by the same individual, and so they reached a multi-million dollar deal, tried to have it enforced and paid out of the insured's policy with James River Insurance Company. And what the Montana Supreme Court said was that given the facts of the case, the deal was obviously the product of collusion, and it therefore said that the consent judgment was unenforceable and rendered judgment for James River. And for listeners who want to get into the nitty-gritty and the years of history in the complex facts of that case, so you can feel free to refer to our prior reporting on the case in Law 360.
There you go. And to tie Abbeyland, and my understanding is that one of the things you promised Natalie was that your first home is going to be called Natalie Land, right?
Yes, and not only that, it's going to be on an island. Might be a little more expensive in California than Montana, but we'll see what we can do.
Oh, that sounds good. Marriages usually wind up costing more than you think. But Abbeyland, to me, illustrates the shenanigans that are often associated with stipulated judgments and demonstrates the importance of allowing insurers latitude in challenging a stipulated judgment and giving them the ability to conduct discovery on the issues of reasonableness and conclusion, because insufficient scrutiny may not only amount to improper abdication of judicial duties by a court, but it may actually result in a court being used as an instrument to facilitate a fraud or injustice. So it took discovery in that case to expose the collusion that was involved. And I think stipulated judgments are more commonly fraught with fraud than courts might want to believe. And the Supreme Court of Montana was entirely justified in refusing to enforce the stipulated judgment against the insurers altogether, and as opposed to enforcing a lesser amount that was deemed to be reasonable, which is what the lower court had done. So both courts had given relief, but the Montana Supreme Court gave more relief in the form of just refusing to enforce that stipulated judgment. So before we leave the state of Montana, because who knows when we're going to get back there, there's the other case that you wrote about, Dragonfly Cattle.
Yes. Yeah, and so as you noted, this decision deals with some of the same issues. The facts were a little different here, but the key or core principles were the same. And so in this case, the insurer, JCCS, entered into, again, a multi-million dollar consent judgment to resolve the case against it, with the promise that the judgment would only be paid of the proceeds of its liability insurance. And so what the Montana Supreme Court did here was it found that the trial court had improperly applied a presumption of reasonableness to the judgment under the facts of this case, and said that the trial court needed to take a second look at the enforceability of the consent judgment without applying such a presumption of reasonableness. So on remand, we'll see what the trial court does with the judgment in this case. But as in the Abbeyland case, the Montana Supreme Court made a statement that these consent judgments between policyholders and third-party plaintiffs are going to be assessed with more scrutiny than they might have been in the past.
And certainly, we and our listeners don't know whether or not Natalie is a vegan, but assuming she isn't, you're going to be dragging white cattle around in greater numbers because you'll have twice as many steaks to put on the grill. In terms of the insurance importance of this, this case reaffirms that where an insurer has defended its policyholder, there's no presumption of reasonableness associated with a stipulated judgment entered between a policyholder and claimant. And of course, again, the insurer here had actually conducted a defense, but there were various allegations, and the court said alleged acts or omissions such as refusing to affirm coverage or not filing a declaratory judgment action to resolve issues raised in a reservations letter, or misrepresenting policy limits by contending that defense costs or road limits, those are not tantamount to breaching the duty to defend. And of course, the court did not find any of those things or that any of those things were a breach of contract, but did determine that those things, even if true, are not tantamount to not providing a defense. So that was sort of my takeaway point from the Dragon case. But so we come on now to the Wisconsin Supreme Court decision in West Bend Mutual versus Medical Supply.
Yes, and so again, we're going a little further afield with a lesser-known state Supreme Court here. And so West Bend versus Ixmas Medical Supply was a duty to defend case. In which this wholesaler of medical supplies and in this particular case, diabetes test strips, was sued by Abbott Laboratories for selling strips that had only been approved for sale in foreign markets, taking them and reselling them in the U.S. And the problem with that is that those types of unapproved blood glucose test strips are not eligible for reimbursement for medical professionals in the U.S. And so trial court had found that there was no duty to defend on the part of Ixmas Medical Supplies liability insurer West Bend because there was no advertising injury, potentially covered advertising injury alleged in Abbott's complaint, and that in any event, the policy exclusion for knowing violation of the rights of another applied. And as readers probably know, the knowing violation exclusion bars coverage for any claims that stem from a policyholder's intentional acts that the policyholder knows or should know would violate third party's rights. And so the Intermediate Appeals Court here reversed, said that there were allegations in Abbott's complaint that could be read as alleging something less than intentional conduct, and given the breadth of the duty to defend, that West Bend therefore had a defense obligation here. And the unanimous Wisconsin Supreme Court affirmed that decision by the Court of Appeal and put the focus on the facts as alleged in the complaint and whether they could conceivably support a covered count rather than the particular legal theories, and so they agreed that given the fact that there were allegations in Abbott's complaint that didn't constitute intentional conduct, that West Bend had a duty to defend, and the knowing violation exclusion did not apply to race coverage here. So, yeah, it was a decision that, in the eyes of the policyholder bar, reinforced the breadth of the duty to defend, and especially as that exists under Wisconsin law.
All right, this is going to be a tough one for me to connect up because I don't suppose you and Natalie are planning on going to Wisconsin for your honeymoon?
No, we already have Kauai booked for spring break of next year. We're not taking a visit to Green Bay, unfortunately.
But you're likely to eat some cheese while you're honeymooning, correct?
Oh, yes. There will be tapas and hors d'oeuvres, and I'm sure cheese will factor into it.
All right, so there's our connection. Cheese, Wisconsin, Wisconsin Supreme Court. So So I think I've succeeded in what I've promised to do here. I call this the lowest hanging fruit test because the court just scoured this 156-page complaint and looked for ways to show with a broad liberal interpretation the allegations were sufficient to implicate a duty to defend, and also noted that although some of the counts causes of action required that there be knowledge, some were strict liability. So that's the way the court got to that decision. And that really is the sum and substance of your list of the key cases from the first half of 2019. It was a case that made my list, but did not make yours. It came toward the end of that mid-year cutoff. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit affirmed a summary judgment ruling in favor of Liberty Mutual in the Varlin case. Liberty in that case had sudden and accidental pollution exclusions in their policies. And Varlin, which was an industrial manufacturer of railway equipment, sought recovery for expenses incurred with respect to two environmental sites. And there the Seventh Circuit upheld the district court's exclusion of the expert opinions offered by Varlin that the releases were sudden and accidental, finding that the expert failed to demonstrate his opinions were based on reliable methods or principles. I'm not going to go into a lot of details on the case, but I think it's important from the standpoint of establishing that, you know, it's not enough for a policyholder to say or speculate that there was a sudden and accidental release. They have to be able to show that either by actual fact evidence or valid expert testimony. And an expert's going to be held to the Daubert standards and has to establish that the scientific validity of its opinions and the conclusions or supposition will not do. And that, ladies and gentlemen, wraps up some of the key decisions from the first half of 2019. I wanted to briefly turn, Jeff, to some of the cases to watch for the second half of 2019. I know the Vanderbilt case in Connecticut before the Connecticut Supreme Court is something on both of our watch lists.
That's right. And so this case, it's captioned R.T. Vanderbilt versus Hartford, deals with a host of issues that arise under asbestos and other long-tail claims disputes. And so the case was argued in the spring, and we should be looking at a decision on it in the fall. And so it touches on issues concerning allocation, a trigger of coverage, and several other key concerns. But perhaps the most controversial part of the Intermediate Appeals Court's opinion in this case was its finding recognizing so-called unavailability of insurance rule or exception to pro rata allocation, under which if a policyholder was unable to purchase insurance for a particular risk, in this case asbestos, then when a court goes about assigning its insurers and the policyholder a pro rata share over a number of years, the policyholder won't be assigned a share for the years in which it can purchase relevant insurance. And so the Connecticut Supreme Court is primed to be the latest state Supreme Court to rule in on this issue, or to weigh in on this issue, apologies. And there are also other issues before the court regarding the proper trigger of coverage in long-tail insurance claims, and also the applicability of the pollution exclusion. But I think the most eyes will be on the court's decision on the unavailability of insurance exception, and we'll see what they end up doing with that.
Well, yep, that's going to be interesting to see what that court does. Hopefully the Supreme Court will do the right thing and also have an opinion a little bit briefer than the appellate division did in that case. So I'm going to talk just for a moment or two on a couple of legislative developments in the state of Florida that I think are of interest. But before I do that, I'm going to pose a question to you, give you a couple minutes to reflect on it, and then after cover these legislative developments, you can come up with your answer. And the question, of course, is what has being a senior reporter for Law 360 done to prepare you to be a good husband? And while you ponder that, the legislative development, the main one I wanted to talk about was a bill recently signed into law in Florida by Governor DeSantis that will become Section 624.1055(1) of the Florida statutes. And our longtime listeners will appreciate that Florida traditionally has been one of a minority of states that did not permit equitable contribution among primary insurers for defense costs. And this will change under the new statute, which provides that defense costs are to be apportioned among all insurers who owe a duty to defend in accordance with the terms of the pertinent policies. And in the absence of policy wordings, courts are empowered to use, quote, such equitable factors as the court determines, unquote, to be appropriate in making an allocation. So we'll have some development, I'm sure, in terms of what those factors are, but it suggests clauses such as other insurance provisions may be considered, but also equitable factors. A couple of things about the statute is it has a notice of claim requirement. So an insurer does not have any obligation to cover pre-tender cost, defense cost, which puts a premium on both policyholders and defending insurers in remaining vigilant in submitting claims and putting other primary carriers on notice. And probably the other thing to point out is it will be effective with respect to claims or suits initiated on or after January 1, 2020. So there's a little lag time in the effective date of that statute, but it provides some redress for insurers who are defending in terms of being able to have those defense costs split with other insurers who have a duty to defend. Also, the Florida legislature has passed a law addressing some of the abuses that are well known to counsel representing insurers as well as policyholders with respect to assignments of benefits. And that comes into play, of course, in first-party losses. And that's a statute people that practice in that area ought to be aware of. All right, Jeff, the moment shines upon you, my friend. What have you learned from covering the insurance beat for Law 360 that prepares you to be a good husband?
I think in one word, patience. taking time every day to read through dozens of pages of complex insurance opinions is just giving me a lot of patience, and I think that applies to relationships as well as reporting on the insurance industry. So hopefully that has given me a good foundation to work with.
Well, I think that's a good answer. Both our producer and executive producer, both ladies, gave thumbs up on your answer. So on that note, we're going to have you back again to talk about the developments during the totality of 2019. By that time, you'll join us as a married man and maybe bring Natalie along with you, which I know our listeners will look forward to. So
great.
Thank you so much, Jeff, for joining us. And ladies and gentlemen, that wraps up our discussion on the first half of 2019. Jeff will continue to keep his eyes on developments for the balance of the year as he's planning for his wedding, and he'll report back to all of us in January of 2020. Once again, thank you, Jeff, Senior Insurance Law Reporter at Law 360, for joining us and updating us. This is Scott Seaman thanking you for joining us on Insurance Law Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We look forward to speaking with you soon on other topics of interest to insurers and reinsurance practitioners, professionals, and decision makers. Thank you for joining us.
You've been listening to Hinshaw & Culbertson LLP's Insurance Law Radio. The information contained in this program is provided solely for general informational purposes and does not constitute legal advice. For information on past and upcoming Insurance Law Radio programs, visit the Insurance Services Practice Group page of www.hinshawlaw.com. This is Royal Oaks thanking you for joining us and inviting you to join us for the next episode of Insurance Law Radio.